Welcome to the History of English podcast, a podcast about the history of the English language. This is episode 12, Early Greek, Hittite, and the Trojan War. Now, over the last few episodes, we've looked at the migration of the original Indo-European tribes from the Eurasian steppes to the areas where the modern Indo-European languages are located. We'll now begin to look at each of the individual Indo-European languages which have directly impacted the history of English, and we'll begin with the early Greeks. But before I begin, let me give a quick thanks to Lewis Henwood and naturalearthdata.com for the fantastic maps which Lewis prepared for the website, historyofenglishpodcast.com. If you haven't checked out the site recently, you might want to check out the pages for episodes 9, 10, and 11. The original maps, which I had originally included, have been updated with the new maps which Lewis prepared, and these are wonderful maps that fully illustrate the migrations which I discussed in those episodes. So thanks again to Lewis. Also, in this episode, I'm going to look at the Indo-European settlement into Greece and Anatolia. And next time, I'm going to look at the classical Greek period and the large number of Greek words which have made their way into modern English. And I'm also going to discuss the development of the alphabet a little bit over the next few episodes. But since I received some requests from a few listeners for more information on the development of the alphabet itself, I think I'll dedicate an entire episode exclusively to the alphabet itself for those of you who are particularly interested in that subject. And I'll give you some more information on that episode shortly, so stay tuned. Now this time, I want to introduce you to the ancient Greeks, and I want to explore the Indo-European roots of those original Greek-speaking people. The Greek language is the biggest influence on modern English, outside of Latin and, of course, English's native Germanic roots. Even if you're not interested in ancient history, you probably know that Greek culture was a major influence on Western civilization. The Greek influence extends into many disciplines which were pioneered in Greece, including music, philosophy, politics, drama, and poetry. All words that come from Greek, by the way. But this is not a podcast about Western civilization. It's a podcast about English. And Greek has had two major influences on English. The first is vocabulary. As you know by now, English is a Germanic language, but it's borrowed heavily from other languages. The biggest source of borrowed words is Latin, including words taken from French, which is a derivative of Latin. But the second biggest source of borrowed words is Greek. Now, ancient Greece existed long before the Anglo-Saxons arrived in Britain, and therefore early Anglo-Saxon English didn't really borrow from Greek. Anglo-Saxon or Old English was much closer to a pure Germanic language. But after the Norman invasion of England in 1066, Latin and French words began to pour into the English vocabulary. And this is also the point at which Greek words began to flow into English as well. And the reason for this connection is the fact that Latin itself had borrowed heavily from Greek. The Romans were fascinated by Greek culture, and they generally sought to adopt the best parts of it into Roman culture. And that meant they borrowed a lot of words from Greek. So a lot of the Latin words which English adopted had Greek origins. And we'll look at a lot of those words as we look at the Greeks in more detail. The next major deposit of Greek words occurred during and after the Renaissance in the late Middle Ages. As you may know, there were two dominant languages in the Roman Empire. Latin, of course, dominated the western portion of the empire, but Greek was the dominant language in the east. Greek had been a lingua franca in the eastern Mediterranean before the Roman conquest, and Latin was never able to replace it there. In fact, when the Roman Empire was eventually divided into western and eastern portions, it was this linguistic divide which served as the basis for the division. The Latin-speaking West evolved into the Western Roman Empire, and the Greek-speaking East evolved into the Eastern Roman Empire, or later called the Byzantine Empire, with its capital at Constantinople. But in 1453, Constantinople fell to the Ottoman Empire, and that led to the disbursement of Greek scholars throughout Western Europe. And they brought with them manuscripts which had been written in ancient Greek, which were previously unknown in the West. The discovery of this pre-Christian Greek culture caused an intellectual, social, and cultural revolution in the West. And this was the Renaissance. And it came with an influx of Greek words associated with all of those things I mentioned earlier: music, philosophy, politics, drama, and poetry. It also extended to architecture, science, and literature. Many of these Greek words were therefore borrowed directly from Greek during the period of modern English. But the major point here is that most Greek words came into English during the Middle English and Modern English periods, so they were later additions to the language for the most part. So Greek vocabulary has influenced English, but I said that there were two major Greek contributions to English. The other influence was the way we write those words, the alphabet. In fact, the word alphabet itself comes from the first two letters of the Greek alphabet, alpha and beta. The history of the alphabet is a fascinating story in itself, and much of the early history of the alphabet involves the entire Eastern Mediterranean. So, while the Greeks will be the focus of the next few episodes, I'll actually be talking about the entire region in order to see all the moving pieces which ultimately come together to deliver the alphabet to the Greeks. The story of the early Greeks in the Eastern Mediterranean also presents some themes which will extend throughout ancient history, and arguably still exist today. During this period, we start to see the conflicts between the Indo-European languages and cultures settling in from the north and the Egyptian, Semitic, and other languages and cultures from the south. We see this in the rivalry between the Hittites and the Egyptians, the Hebrews and the Philistines, the Greeks and the Phoenicians, and the Roman Empire and the native Aramaic speakers during the early Christian era. Each of these cases involves a conflict between Indo-European speaking civilizations and Egyptian or Semitic civilizations. So it's interesting to look at these events from a linguistic perspective. Many of these events also provide a backdrop to the development and spread of the alphabet. So in this episode, I'm going to look at the settlement of the first Indo-Europeans into Anatolia and Greece. And I'm going to explore the rise and fall of the Hittite Empire and the first Greek civilization. And I'm going to explain how these events are connected to the emergence of the first alphabet and the adoption of that alphabet by the Greeks. So there's lots of ancient history here. So let's begin the story of the Greeks and the Eastern Mediterranean with the arrival of the first Indo-Europeans, the Hittites and the Greeks. When we think about ancient Greece, I think we tend to think about the early rivalry between Athens and Sparta, and we think about the rise of Greek culture, the great philosophers like Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. When we think of architecture like the Acropolis and the Parthenon, and military heroes like Alexander the Great, but all of those things are part of the era which extended from around 800 BC to the first century BC, when the Greeks were finally defeated by the Romans. And until the late 1800s, this was really the oldest known period of Greek history. Virtually nothing was known about Greece before this period. Greek history basically began with the rise of the various city-states like Athens, Sparta, and Corinth. Now, we did have a couple of epic poems which you've probably heard of, the Iliad and the Odyssey. These epics were attributed to Homer around the very beginning of this period. And these epic poems described an ancient Greek civilization at war with Troy in the so-called Trojan War. But these were considered fictional accounts. They weren't really considered history. I mean, the poems mentioned a Greek city called Mycenae and the city-state of Troy, as well as other cities which no longer existed. So all of this was generally considered the stuff of legend. Mycenae and Troy were placed in the same category as Atlantis, legendary but mythological places. But archaeological discoveries in the late 1800s and early 1900s revealed that there actually was a Mycenae and a city of Troy. And shields, which are described by Homer as basically having the shape of a figure eight, were also unearthed. Now, shields of this nature had only been known in these epic poems, which were thought to be fiction. And they didn't exist during the later Greek period. And yet, here they were. We now know that at least parts of the Iliad and the Odyssey were rooted in fact. Not that the stories themselves were factual, but it turns out there really was a city of Troy and an ancient Greek civilization which predated the known history of Greece. And it turns out that there probably was a Trojan War, and that war may have provided the backdrop for the stories which passed through the generations in the oral tradition before Homer finally reduced them to writing. And by the way, not coincidentally, the Iliad and the Odyssey were written down for the first time just after the alphabet was adopted by the Greeks, around 800 BC. So these were the first works captured for posterity by the alphabet. And also, not coincidentally, that's when the written recorded history of Greece began. Once the Greeks had the alphabet, they could begin to keep historical records. So that's why our knowledge of Greece before that date was largely unknown. There was no alphabet before then, so no known written records existed. So this was all prehistory. And the same thing was basically true of the Hittites to the east in Anatolia. Prior to the early 1900s, nothing was really known about them outside of a few references in the Old Testament of the Bible. For example, it stated that King David had a Hittite named Uriah killed in battle in order to keep his wife Bathsheba. But everyone assumed that the Hittites were just some random Middle Eastern tribe like many others mentioned in the Old Testament. But archaeological discoveries changed everything. In the mid-1800s, the ruins of a large ancient city were discovered in central Anatolia. The city contained walls, monuments, and reliefs with hieroglyphic inscriptions, but no one knew what the city was or what language the inscriptions were written in. Over the next few decades, people in Anatolia began to come across monuments and statues, reliefs, stamp seals, all with similar-looking hieroglyphics. And these were being found throughout central Anatolia. All of this suggested some ancient civilization, but no one really knew what it was. In the late 1800s, an Oxford professor named Archibald Henry Seiza claimed to have found a connection between all of these monuments. And he also claimed that he had partially deciphered one of the stone reliefs. He concluded that all of the inscriptions belonged to the Hittites. Again, at this time, no one really knew anything about the Hittites. The big surprise was that these Hittites occupied such a large kingdom and weren't just some obscure tribe as previously thought. After this discovery, archaeologists began to travel to Turkey to investigate this ancient civilization. And these archaeologists uncovered even more tablets. But these were written in a separate form of early writing called cuneiform. And many of these texts were composed in Akkadian, which was the international language of the region at the time. And since Akkadian had already been deciphered, it was possible to actually read these inscriptions. And they soon discovered a clay tablet which referred to a certain unpleasantness between the Egyptians and the Hittites. The tablet was actually a peace treaty between the Egyptian pharaoh, Ramses II, and the Hittites, which was signed after the Battle of Kadesh. That made the treaty over 3,000 years old, and it's generally considered to be the first known written peace treaty. It's still actually exhibited at the entrance of the Security Council in the United Nations in New York. As I said, many of the texts were composed in Akkadian, which was sort of a lingua franca of the region. But many others were composed in an unknown language, which scholars concluded had to be Hittite. The Czech linguist Bedrich Hrozny studied the inscriptions, and he quickly concluded that the language was an Indo-European language. One day, he isolated the word for bread, and he concluded that a phrase containing the word bread also had to have the words for eat and drink. And from that, he deciphered a complete sentence. Now you will eat bread. Further, you will drink water. What Hrozny had discovered was Hittite, the oldest known Indo-European language. And based upon Hrozny's initial work, other scholars were able to decipher over 25,000 tablets and other inscriptions all written in this Hittite language. This included treaties, letters, laws, rituals, and prayers. These documents also mentioned specific cities and kings and queens and historical events. From these inscriptions and other research, we now know a great deal about the ancient Hittite Empire and the Hittite people. But since the Hittite language didn't have any direct impact on English, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it here. But the Hittite civilization is a player in our overall story of the Eastern Mediterranean, so there are a few things you should know about that civilization. As I mentioned in the last episode, the Hittites entered Anatolia from the Indo-European homeland north of the Black Sea sometime around 2000 BC. Now, the area where the Hittite ancestors settled in Anatolia was previously occupied by people called the Hatti, and they called this particular region Hatti. And the arriving Hittites apparently moved in and conquered the native Hatti people around 1700 BC. Now, the Hittites called the area the Land of the Hatti after the Hattians they had conquered, and this is the basis of the name Hittite. And it's believed that around 1650 BC, the Hittite ruler managed to join all the various local people under his rule, thereby establishing the Hittite kingdom. And the Hittite kingdom soon evolved into a great empire. It actually took a place beside Egypt and Assyria as a major political power in the Near East. And these major regional powers were soon to be joined by the early Greeks, but more on that in a minute. Now, soon after the Hittites conquered the native Hattians, their armies became powerful enough to challenge the great powers of the Near East. They looted Babylon, and they fought the Assyrians. The Hittite Empire reached its peak in the 14th century BC, and it expanded its power to the south, into Syria, at the expense of the Egyptians. Meanwhile, Egyptian influence and control extended from Egypt northward, all the way to the Hittite territory around Syria. So the stage was set for a major showdown between these two ancient powers. And interestingly, one of the sparks which ignited the great battle between the Egyptians and the Hittites involved the Egyptian ruler who would become known as one of the most famous mummies in the world, King Tut. Around 1327 BC, King Tut, or Tutankhamun, died at a very young age without any children. His widow frantically sent a letter to the Hittite king proposing a marriage alliance between herself and one of the Hittite king's sons. In the letter, Tut's widow vowed that she would not marry one of her subjects and that she was very much afraid. The Hittite king sent one of his sons to Egypt, but the son was murdered as soon as he reached the Egyptian border. And then Tut's widow was forced to marry one of her subjects, a royal advisor. But an immediate war was averted when the Hittite king himself died a short time later. But the murder of the Hittite king's son and the surrounding circumstances led to a great deal of unease between the Hittites and the Egyptians. And there was a period of cold war for a while, but in 1265 BC, the Egyptian pharaoh, Ramses II, launched a campaign against the Hittites to seize control of Kadesh in modern Syria. This was an attempt to break the Hittite power and gain control over the entire region for Egypt. The Battle of Kadesh is considered the first documented battle in world history, and it's also considered the greatest chariot battle of all time. Ramses II was nearly defeated in battle, but he had split his army, and the reinforcements arrived just in time to prevent defeat. But the battle ultimately resulted in a stalemate. And the result of this battle was the peace treaty between the Hittites and the Egyptians, which I mentioned earlier, and which is still located at the UN in New York. Now, Egypt and the Hittite kingdom coexisted for around another century, and they even entered into an alliance around 1258 BC against the rising power of the Assyrians to the east. And it's at this point that we have to turn our attention to the west, at the rise of a new power in the region, the ancient Greek civilization. The exact time and manner in which the first Indo-Europeans arrived in Greece is unknown. They might have come through western Anatolia and then traveled to Greece by sea around 2400 to 2200 BC. And this was a period when Greece was experiencing a great deal of immigration. And this view would help to explain some of the connections between the Greek language and the earliest Armenian language and Indo-Iranian languages. The other view is that the Indo-Europeans arrived in Greece via the Balkans from beyond the Danube. And that's the view I presented in the last episode. A third related possibility is that they arrived via the Balkans and then traveled into Anatolia, where they stayed for a while, and then traveled westward into Greece. Regardless, it appears that the first Indo-European Greeks settled in modern Greece shortly before 2000 BC. So this was around the same time the Hittites were settling into central Anatolia to the east. It also appears that successive waves of Indo-Europeans arrived in the Greek peninsula, with each subsequent group speaking a slightly different dialect, which may explain the division of Greek dialects into Western and Eastern groups. So as we look at Greece, we have to consider what was there when the first Indo-Europeans arrived. For the most part, we have some native peoples who fished and hunted, and some lived in small farming communities. They were also making bronze tools by mixing copper and tin, sometimes copper and arsenic. Outside of some general archaeological evidence, very little is known about these people who preceded the Indo-Europeans in mainland Greece. And part of the reason for the use of 2000 BC as the arrival date of the Indo-Europeans in Greece is the archaeological evidence. And this evidence indicates that sites throughout the region were sacked and burned by invaders in a wave around 2100 BC, and then in a second and larger wave around 1900 BC. And objects from this period which have been unearthed contain depictions of peoples with beards and distinctly European appearance accompanied by large swords and chariots and horses, all of these things which are closely associated with the Indo-Europeans, as we've discussed in prior episodes. So that's mainland Greece and the many surrounding small islands. But if we move away from the Greek mainland and look southward into the Aegean Sea, we find a large island known as Crete. And it turns out that there was not only a civilization in place there when the Indo-Europeans arrived, but it was in fact a quite old and advanced civilization. It was the ancient Minoan civilization, which was unearthed just over a century ago, around 1900, by the Englishman Arthur Evans. And this civilization had a great king named Minos, so Evans called it the Minoan civilization. But remember, this civilization on Crete was in place before the Indo-Europeans arrived, so they did not speak an Indo-European language. And even though it existed in the area we know today as Greece, many historians consider it to be pre-Greek, since the Greek language is associated with the Indo-Europeans who arrived later. Now, in the centuries following their arrival in Greece at around 2000 BC, the Indo-Europeans established their own civilization centered around the city of Mycenae. And therefore, this civilization is known to us today as the Mycenaean civilization. And their language was the ancient ancestor of classical Greek and eventually modern Greek. They also developed a highly centralized bureaucratic system of administration. Now, as you may recall from earlier, the Hittite Empire over in Anatolia began to rise to power about 1650 BC. And at this same time in Greece, Mycenaean warrior kings ruled over Mycenae and other parts of Greece. And Mycenaean power grew in Greece just as the Hittite power grew in Anatolia. A couple of centuries later, the Mycenaeans conquered the Minoan civilization on Crete and seized power there as well. And it's at this point that the Mycenaeans began to assimilate the Minoan culture into their own culture. This included Minoan art and architecture, customs, and style of dress. And the Mycenaeans also began to write down their language for the first time by adopting the script which the Minoans were using. And since this is one of the first instances of an Indo-European people adopting a written language, I think it's important to take a look at exactly what was going on here. Now, the Minoans over in Crete, remember, they predated the arrival of the Indo-Europeans, and they had kept official records by writing symbols on clay from very near the beginning of their civilization. And this had started as simple picture writing, somewhat similar to Egyptian hieroglyphics. But sometime between 1900 BC and 1700 BC, the Minoans had developed a second script, which was a linear script, which is known today as Linear A. Again, it was linear, meaning that it wasn't pictures like some hieroglyphics, or wedge-shaped markings like cuneiform. It was written in lines, and at first glance resembles an alphabet, but it was not an alphabet, as we'll see in a moment. Interestingly, linguists have never been able to decipher this script. There's no bilingual Rosetta Stone to help, but the language written in Linear A is definitely not Greek. The Greeks were just beginning to settle into mainland Greece at this time, but their influence had not yet reached the Minoans down in Crete. Now, some linguists believe that this Minoan script, called Linear A, may have been a script obtained or derived from the scripts or writing system used by the Semitic tribes in and around Egypt and the Middle East during this period. And as we'll see later, the later Greek alphabet was borrowed from Phoenicians who were a Semitic people. The Semitic tribes had apparently invented an alphabet very early on, and in fact, some historians believe that the Minoans themselves were originally a Semitic people who had traveled there from the Nile Delta around 1800 BC. Other historians have argued that the Minoans originated in Anatolia. But regardless of their origin, they were definitely using this Linear A script when the Mycenaeans began to arrive in Crete. But keep in mind that this script was not an alphabet. It was a syllabic form of writing. In other words, it used the same basic approach as hieroglyphics and cuneiform, which I'll discuss in more detail later. All of these forms of writing used symbols, or a script, for the sound of syllables. So, ba would have a symbol, and at would have a symbol, and al would have a symbol. And as we'll see, this system works, but it's very inefficient. An alphabet, though, breaks syllables down into basic sounds and phonemes. So rather than a symbol for ba, there's a symbol called a letter for b, and a symbol or letter for a. And an alphabet allows you to put those two together to form ba. But here's the key. There are only a few basic phonemes in most languages, typically only about a couple of dozen. So with an alphabet, you only have to master a handful of letters. In modern English, it's 26. And you can spell any word in that language. I mean, even children can do it. And they do, in fact, learn to do it in grade school, if not before. But with a syllabic writing system, there are hundreds of symbols to represent each possible syllable that may exist within that language. So you can see why the alphabet quickly replaced syllabic writing systems once it was introduced. It was easy to learn, and it spread very, very quickly, and therefore literacy spread with it. But at this early point in Greece, we don't have the alphabet yet. We just have this syllabic script known as Linear A. Now, as I said, the early Mycenaean Greeks, who were the first Indo-European Greeks, they began to move southward, and they settled in the areas of southern Greece. And eventually, they set their sights on Crete itself. And around 1450 BC, it appears that the Mycenaeans invaded and took control of Crete from the Minoans. And many historians think that this invasion was made in conjunction with or shortly after a volcanic eruption, which destroyed a large portion of the capital city of Crete. But regardless of the method and motivation, the Mycenaeans took control of Crete from the Minoans around 1450 BC. And part of the reason why we know this happened around this time is that the Minoan script, Linear A, disappeared at this time, and it was replaced by a completely new script called Linear B. And this Linear B script not only exists from this point on in Crete for several centuries, but it also began to appear afterwards throughout mainland Greece as well. And it wasn't until 1952, literally 60 years ago, that the Linear B script was deciphered. And it turned out to be a very early form of Greek. In fact, it is what we call today Mycenaean Greek, the original Greek language of the first Indo-Europeans. Now, since the shift from the original Linear A script to the new Linear B script occurred in Crete around 1450 BC, it's believed that this represents the point at which the Mycenaeans took over there. And it also suggests that the Mycenaeans borrowed this script for their own Indo-European language and converted it into the new Linear B script. And from there, this script spread throughout mainland Greece, as I mentioned earlier. But remember that this was a syllabic script. And as I've already explained, syllabic scripts were hard to work with. In order to read and write any syllabic script, whether it be hieroglyphics or cuneiform or Linear A or Linear B, you had to memorize symbols or markings for every possible syllable which occurred in the language. Very few people could actually do this. Linear B consisted of 85 signs and dozens of other symbols. Consequently, it's estimated that as few as 5% of the Mycenaean Greeks could actually read or write this Linear B script. So these early Mycenaean Greeks had a written language, but it was of very limited use, pretty much just for government and commercial functions. But even then, very few people were capable of using it. The Greeks would have to wait another 500 years for the alphabet to arrive, an alphabet that would change communication forever. Now, during this very early period of Greek history, there were actually several Greek dialects being spoken throughout Greece, and this included Mycenaean, Aeolic, Doric, and Attic Ionic. The Attic dialect was spoken in and around Athens, and as Athens emerged as a dominant city-state, the Attic dialect eventually emerged as the dominant dialect in Greece, forming the basis of classical Greek and eventually modern Greek. But that's later in our story. Now, following the Mycenaean takeover of Crete, Mycenaean civilization spread with trade and cultural influences throughout the Aegean, and they spread to Egypt and Phoenicia in the Middle East, and the Hittite kingdom over in Anatolia. They even spread to southern Italy. And Mycenaean Greece emerged as one of the three great powers in the eastern Mediterranean, together with the Hittite kingdom in the east and the Egyptian civilization to the south. But by the 13th century BC, just about everything I've discussed in this episode was about to be turned upside down and destroyed. Mycenaean Greece, the Mycenaean writing system, Linear B, the Hittite kingdom, all of it would soon be wiped away. And even the mighty Egyptian civilization would be rocked to its core and almost destroyed. And to this day, historians only have a vague sense of what happened. This period is often referred to by historians as the invasion of the Sea Peoples, based upon an inscription found in Egypt which described the episode. And there are many theories about what happened here. It appears that around 1250 BC, Mycenaean Greece was subjected to a couple of major problems. First, it appears that Greece was experiencing problems with overpopulation. But secondly, and maybe more importantly, the Indo-European tribes to the north of Greece, in and around the Balkans, well, they were still there, and they were still on the move. Remember that the modern Indo-European language represents remnants of some of these early Indo-European tribes. But they certainly don't represent all of the tribes. There were many Indo-European tribes who have long since been lost to history. Some of these tribes may have been small in number, and others may have been defeated or may have been assimilated into other tribes or cultures. But at this point in our story, they were still out there, and many of them were located in the area north of Greece, in the Danube Valley and in the Balkans. Remember from the last episode that the ancestors of the Latin speakers and the Celts were also situated in this region for many centuries around this same time period. And these tribes and other Indo-European tribes were putting constant pressure on the Mycenaean Greeks to the south. These tribes included the Dorians, who would eventually become integrated into Greece. And these external pressures combined with internal pressures from overpopulation to create a period of instability. And soon internal warfare and fighting began to break out as the Mycenaeans began to compete for increasingly limited economic resources. During this ancient heroic age, the Anatolian city of Troy emerged as an obvious and tempting target. Now, as I said earlier, Troy was an actual city. It was located on the western coast of Anatolia, but it was considered part of the Greek sphere of influence, which extended into western Anatolia during this period. Now, very little is known about the actual peoples of Troy, who were called the Trojans, and their language is unknown as well. The Trojans apparently didn't have a written language, which was not unusual at the time. Archaeologists have unearthed a Hittite seal in the ancient city of Troy, which was inscribed in Luwian, which is one of those other related Anatolian languages. But it appears that the Hittites had very limited influence over Troy. Now, Homer's epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, feature Trojans who converse freely with the Greeks. But this is generally considered to be artistic license. The reality is that they probably spoke a different language, but many linguists think the Trojans were, in fact, part of the Indo-European culture, and they probably spoke an Indo-European language. And that would make sense if you think about it. I mean, they were surrounded by the Anatolian languages to the east and the Greek language to the west, and all of them being Indo-European languages. It's believed that the Trojans were related to the Greeks, probably due to some common Indo-European ancestry and culture, but the exact nature of those connections is unknown. And as I mentioned earlier, even though Troy was located next door to the Hittite kingdom, it's believed that the Trojans actually had more connections with the Mycenaean Greeks than they did with the Hittite kingdom. And the fact that Mycenaean artifacts have been uncovered at Troy suggests that there must have been some extensive trade between the Mycenaeans and the Trojans. But again, we may never know the full story of the relationship between Troy and Greece. It appears, though, that around 1250 or 1200 BC, the Mycenaeans went to war with the Trojans in what would become known as the Trojan War. The Mycenaean Greeks attacked Troy, which provided a factual backdrop to the stories later recounted in the Iliad and the Odyssey, stories that were probably passed down in the oral tradition from this period until they were finally written down and attributed to Homer some 400 years later, right after the alphabet finally arrived in Greece. Now, the Iliad story of the seduction of Helen by a Trojan prince is almost certainly fiction. The siege of Troy for 10 years may also be fiction. But it does appear to be true that the city of Troy was destroyed around this time. But the fact that Troy was destroyed does not appear to be that unusual in retrospect. The city of Troy, destroyed around the time of the Trojan War, was in fact the seventh city built on the site, and the unearthed remains suggest that the city which was destroyed around the time of the Trojan War was a shell of its former self. It doesn't appear to match the descriptions in the Iliad at all, really. So it does appear that there's some basic truth behind the story of the Iliad, but how much of it is true is still a mystery. Shortly after the destruction of Troy, around 1200 BC, the invasion of the Sea Peoples began. And again, historians are not 100% sure what happened at this point. It appears that peoples from the north of Greece, likely Indo-European tribes, they swept through Mycenaean Greece and caused a domino effect of destruction and devastation throughout the eastern Mediterranean. Historians originally thought these invaders from the north were the Dorians themselves, a specific group of Indo-Europeans, and some histories still advance that view, but it now appears that by the time the Dorians arrived in around 1100 BC, the destruction had already occurred, and the Dorians basically filled the vacuum. Others believe the Dorians were already settled in Greece before the invaders from the north arrived. So, as you can see, name a theory and there's an historian somewhere who will probably argue its validity. But the general sense today is that these invaders were not, in fact, the Dorians, as many earlier historians had thought. The fact is, history cannot really identify exactly who these people were. But they did wear horned helmets, and they used ox-drawn covered wagons. So every indication is that these people were Indo-European tribes, ultimately from the Eurasian steppes, just like the ancestors of the Mycenaeans themselves. Whoever these invaders from the north were, they sacked and burned the Mycenaean cities around 1120 BC. Again, it's very likely that these were just the latest in a series of invaders from the north who had been putting pressure on the Mycenaeans for decades. And they overran Greece, and by 1100 BC, all of the main Mycenaean centers had fallen to attacks by these invaders. And they continued on eastward, through the Hittite Empire in Anatolia, which collapsed in 1180 BC, and they continued down the Phoenician coast, all the way to Egypt, where they were finally defeated by Ramses III. Egyptian historical records refer to an invasion of sea people, quote-unquote, at this time, which could be a reference to these invaders from the north, or it could be a reference to the Mycenaean Greeks who were fleeing from the devastation in Greece. Either way, after their defeat by the Egyptians, the northern invaders were generally lost to history. But they left total devastation in their wake. In the aftermath of the invasion, Mycenaeans flooded outward, looking for new lands, and their civilization basically faded into history. And a domino effect ensued, with waves of mass migrations and disruptions throughout the Aegean and the eastern Mediterranean. As I said, both the Mycenaean Greek civilization and the Hittite civilization were destroyed and lost to history until modern archaeology rediscovered them. And even though Egypt was able to beat back the Sea People, the sphere of Egypt's influence was pushed back to the Nile, and its influence in Palestine was effectively ended. States in Syria, Palestine, and Cyprus were also attacked. Babylonia dissolved at the same time in 1154 BC after wars with Assyria and Elam, and destruction occurred throughout the entire region. In the wake of the collapse of the Hittite civilization, a group of Indo-Europeans settled in from the north there as well. These people were called the Phrygians. They settled in the northwestern part of Anatolia, but they were illiterate. And Greek tradition says that the Phrygians came from an earlier homeland, again in southeastern Europe. As you may recall from episode 3 on the Indo-European family tree, I mentioned Phrygian as another branch of the Indo-European family tree. And some linguists include it as a branch, even though we know almost nothing about the language itself. Now, the Phrygians actually prospered under a king named Midas, or Mida. And the later-day Greeks were so impressed with the rule of King Mida that they developed the legend of King Midas from his reign. Everything King Midas touched turned to gold. And this is the root of a phrase which often appears in English, which was borrowed from the Greeks. A Midas touch is the ability to profit from any effort. Now, with the collapse of the Hittites and the Mycenaean Greeks and the weakening of ancient Egypt, a major power vacuum resulted in the areas around modern-day Lebanon and Israel. Now, this vacuum allowed the largely Semitic populations in and around Palestine, especially the Hebrews and the Phoenicians, to establish small independent states in this region along the eastern Mediterranean. So here we have the beginnings of Israel, as well as the Phoenicians, who would soon give the Western world the alphabet. And another group of people also settled in the same narrow strip of land. They were the Philistines, who were the arch enemies of the early Hebrews, and who are believed by many historians to be remnants of the sea peoples defeated by the Egyptians. Now, if that's true, these Philistines would have been either part of the original Indo-European invaders who caused the disruptions, or Greek refugees who were beaten back by the Egyptians and settled in the same general area as the Hebrews and the Phoenicians. Meanwhile, the Mycenaean Greek civilization disappeared in the aftermath of these disruptions, as did its Linear B script. For the next three centuries, virtually nothing is known about the history of Greece. This period represents the so-called Greek Dark Ages. And just like the period after the fall of the Roman Empire in Europe, which is called the Dark Ages there, that's in part because the written historical accounts largely disappeared after the fall of the Roman Empire. And it's the same thing that happened in Greece. After the Mycenaean civilization disappeared, we have this extended period of about three centuries where there are no written records or accounts. So we call this period the Greek Dark Ages because virtually nothing is known about the history of Greece during this period. But finally, around 800 BC, the alphabet finally emerged in Greece. And when that happened, the Greeks could start writing again. And thanks to that alphabet, which was easy to learn and master, literacy spread like wildfire. And it's probably not surprising that one of the first works written in this new alphabet was a collection of epic poems about that great conflict, the Trojan War. These poems recounted the ancient past of Greece, of Mycenae and Troy. They had been passed along and recounted by bards for centuries in the oral tradition, which was the only way to pass along these stories without a written language. Throughout the Greek Dark Ages, these stories were told and sung, and perhaps embellished. And even though the written versions of these stories, which we know today as the Iliad and the Odyssey, are attributed to a blind bard named Homer, we don't really know if he was the source or not. We don't even know if he really existed. But we do know that the Iliad had been composed and was reduced to writing about 750 BC, and the Odyssey came a short time thereafter. And the Iliad concerned the siege of Troy, and the Odyssey concerned Odysseus' travel home after the Trojan War. These works also mark Greece's emergence from three centuries of Dark Ages, and they represent the beginning of the period of Greek history with which we're all familiar. So next time, I'm going to look at the Greece following its emergence from the Dark Ages. That'll be the story of literate Greece, Greece with the alphabet, and a written language that was available to the masses. And we'll look at the vast hoard of Greek words which have made their way into English from this period. So, until next time, thanks for listening to the History of English podcast.